Just had lunch. We had two excellent talks this morning on cancer.
The
I have a severe
work.
Mic doesn't work. And as I was saying, I'm severely jet-lagged, so we'll get started now. So, that's the title of my talk, Protein Regulated Networks, Evolution and the Role of Intrinsically Disordered Protein. So it's going to be a little different than what we heard this morning. I'll try not to be repetitious, but I guess I can't help it because the slides were already made. And I didn't realize what the content of my predecessors would be. So you'll have to bear with me a little bit, but I'll try to, as I said, not be repetitious. Oops. Okay, first of all, I will start off with thanking the organizers, particularly Vidyanand and Dr. Mansi Palni, for the invitation and this excellent opportunity to be here. And a special thanks to Kriti for all the help, without which it would not be feasible. She did an outstanding job. And here's what the outline of my talk is going to be for this afternoon. So, first of all, let me tell you that this is not a polished talk. I'm not going to show you too much data, things that we've already published, or some experimental details, but rather I would use this opportunity to make some conceptual ideas that I would like to share with you, and how they either match or do not match with the predecessors who talked before me this morning. Yeah. So basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you an overview of cancer just to impress on you how complicated that is, which you already have gauged by now. And I also realize that it's a very, very heterogeneous audience. And so I would like to keep it as simple as we can, so use less of technical jargon and not show off that we know a little bit of cancer compared to anything else that we know. Then I will move on to talk about intrinsically disordered proteins. I'm not too sure how many of you are familiar with this. So again, I will not attempt an academic exercise, but nonetheless give you an overview of what these intrinsically disordered proteins are all about and how they fit into protein regulatory networks. And then finally tie the whole thing together and give you our perspective on how we think these intrinsically disordered proteins may indeed be contributing to the initiation and progression of cancer in general. Okay? For the most part, I'm going to use prostate cancer as a model simply because it's a little bit different than the models you heard this morning. Second of all, we have some familiarity. That's our model system we work with. And third of all, it has very unique and very interesting features that I would like to walk you through, just to give you an idea. Okay. So unfortunately, my laser is... So here's the prostate gland. I'm sure most of you know that, but just in case you happen to. It's an accessory sex organ that's located right below the bladder. And this dotted line here is a region to which the urethra passes through the prostate. So the urethra is the... And so the prostate pretty much surrounds the urethra. And it has several anatomical regions, so I will not attempt an exercise in that, but it's suffice to say that there are some very unique features about it, in that the prostate has been characterized, the diseased prostate, that is, has been characterized two types of diseases in men. Yeah? First of all, there is a disease which is called the prostate benign prostatic hyperplasia, BPH, which by definition is benign. It's not cancer, it's very different. And then we have prostate cancer. But the two diseases affect the two different regions of the gland. Yeah. So anatomically, as I said, the prostate cancer affects the peripheral region that's outside, while as the BPH affects the transitional zone, which is on the inside of the prostate. So why this geographic discrepancy is not very clear, but in a majority of the cases, that's what you see when you do surgery on these patients. Yeah. So, we'll stick to prostate cancer for the most part, but I just wanted to bring that up. The reason being that both diseases are androgen dependent. So, for the most part, depriving the patient of androgen is a first step in clinical therapy for prostate diseases. So here's prostate cancer, and as we saw repeatedly this morning, there is this schematic view that is graphically represented for any type of cancer, if you will. You have the initiation, perhaps, is at the... I'm sorry, this is frustrating me. But, okay. So...
You can use the arrow on your...
Ah, yeah, good idea. Let me see.
It's a very small dot.
Sorry?
It's a very small dot.
They're very small. You can't see the arrow either.
Can you see it on your screen?
No.
Oh.
I'm not that jet lagged, so I should be able to see this. Okay, we'll do without. But basically what I'm referring to is PIN, and PIN is here, prostatic endothelial neoplasia. So this is the precursor actually for prostate disease.
Please use the mic.
I'm sorry. Okay. I'll stick to this. All right. So that's the initial stage, the very first stage, if you will. PIN is supposed to progress to high-grade PIN, which progresses to localized prostate cancer. And then, of course, we have metastasis. We heard a lot about that this morning. And every cancer is different, yeah? So in the case of prostate cancer, the preferred regions or organs in the body to which it metastasizes are the bone, that's been shown there. Of course, the first place it goes to is the lymph node. Let me make that very clear. From the lymph node, it escapes by extravasation. Then it gets into the circulatory system via the lymphatic ducts. And then it metastasizes either to the bone, sometimes to the liver, but definitely to the lung, and very rarely to the brain. So as far as prostate cancer goes, these are basically the regions where it metastasizes. So it brings up interesting questions. Why are other regions in the body exempted, if you will, from this metastatic process? And why does breast cancer go to something else versus lung cancer goes to some other organ? But by and large, the lung seems to be a preferred site for metastasis of most cancers, if not all the cancers. Yeah. And as I said, one of the preliminary or primary medical modality is androgen resistance. So initially, androgen deprivation is quite successful in most patients. Yeah? But as everything else in cancer, the patients become androgen resistant, and that's when it gets really lethal. But what I also want to point out is you see those two fan-shaped structure on that apple-like structure, that's the prostate. The fan-shaped structure, they're labeled as amino vesicles. They're in such close proximity, actually the ducts do connect to prostate ducts, but nonetheless you never get metastasis, almost never ever get metastasis to the amino vesicle. Yeah? Not only that, you never have amino vesicle cancer in itself. Yeah? So that's pretty strange and quite enigmatic as to why only this particular region and this organ develops cancer, while as the adjoining region does not. And by the same argument, as I said, the prostate is juxtaposed to the bladder, and the bladder does get bladder cancer, right? But some amino vesicles don't. So there are some very intriguing questions that then one can ask about the nature of this disease. So, what is the hallmark of cancer? We already discussed this morning. Like Carlos pointed out, only a pathologist will certify that this given tissue is cancerous or not. And what the pathologist is looking at using just light microscopy is for these kind of monstrous chromosomal abnormalities. So on the top you have, this is pseudocolored, obviously chromosomes are not colored in pink and green. So this is a Skype and a Skype. And on top you have the normal chromosomes, and you see a beautiful set of 23 pairs, X and Y and sex chromosomes. And down below you see a specimen from cancer. Of course this is exaggerated, but what I want to impress on you is that many times you see the chromosomes entirely missing, sometimes you see additional chromosomes showing up, and sometimes you see that there are translocations which could be either balanced or unbalanced. Yeah? But all in all, it looks like inside a cancer cell is a veritable gallery of horrors, as is described by Gene Marks in this nice article. So, it's not only that there's a lot of chromosomal abnormalities, but it's also that it's extremely heterogeneous. So, in other words, as we discussed this morning again, it's not that any given cells or any given two foci in a prostate are identical. Yeah. So if you take two different regions in the prostate, which we do by needle biopsy, not the most pleasant experience for somebody who's had it. It's pretty cruel. Nonetheless, if you take those two needle biopsies, and if you do, nowadays you can do a single cell genome sequencing, and that's been done as well at Hopkins. And we know that there's extreme heterogeneity, so much so that it's been compared to a quasi-species. So we know Manfred Eigen coined this term, quasi-species, and he likened cancer to a quasi-species. So that said, it is not surprising that, as we heard this morning again, that most people believe that all cancers arise as a result of changes that have occurred in the DNA sequence of the genomes in cancer cells. This is a direct quote from a very prominent cancer researcher in the UK. His name is Mike Stranton. And a similar quote you can find by Bert Vogelstein, who is the most prominent personality on the Hopkins campus, a very leading cancer researcher. Yeah. And what would have led them to make this kind of a statement is well described in this slide in this review that I took shamelessly. And let me try to walk you through, although it's an extremely busy slide. Yeah. So he starts with the fertilized egg, progresses all the way to a chemo-resistant recurrence. And what he's trying to show you is there is this intrinsic mutation process starting right after gestation. Well, you don't see the mutation right there, but somewhere during childhood is where you begin to accumulate these intrinsic mutations, and you progressively accumulate more and more. And down there he shows the ones that may be due to environment and lifestyle exposures. And further down in red, he shows you the mutator phenotype. Now, those of you who are geneticists immediately appreciate the idea of the mutator phenotype. And then those in green are the ones that are in response to chemotherapy. Yeah. So these numbers down there are pretty staggering, actually. If you look at the tens to thousands of mitoses, depending on an organ, ten to hundreds, depending on cancer, and tens to hundred thousands or more per passenger mutation. So they divide the mutations. Now, this is very fashionable in cancer research, that they have come to agree that not all mutations contribute to cancer in itself. Yeah. So obviously there are some, there is no denial that there are some mutations that must be very, very important role in cancer. So those have been labeled as the driver mutations. And the ones that they think do not contribute, perhaps, are now labeled as the passenger mutations. So you have about 1 or 10, that's the number that they came up with, driver mutations that may be responsible, actually, for cancer initiation as well as perhaps progression as well, as also resistance to drug therapy. So what that means, then, is that somebody's talking outside. Okay, what that means then is that cancer can be viewed as a Darwinian evolutionary process, and as many of you may know, Peter Noel in 1976 synthesized this theory where he called it a process of genetic instability and natural selection. So just like Darwin professed, there are mutations that pre-exist, which bestows a selective advantage to the species, and with the change in environment, those species that can adapt well get selected and the others get eliminated. So this clearly implies, although inadvertently by the professors of this theory, is that the information flow is unidirectional, and there it goes just from genotype to phenotype. So, on the other hand, I also want to present overwhelming evidence that we argue against this particular idea that information flow is unidirectional. Yeah? And that cancer is caused or initiated only by mutations. For example, I think we also touched upon this in the second talk on the first one. This is a slide I borrowed from the famous book, The Biology of Cancer by Bob Weinberg. And he has borrowed it in turn from a paper that appeared in mid-70s by a group in Berkeley. So what this paper is showing is they took a temperature-sensitive RSV mutant, Rous sarcoma virus mutant, and at the permissive temperature, if you transform a normal cell with this mutant, the cell gets transformed and you get a transformed phenotype. In other words, it causes cancer. Yeah? And if you move these transformed cells to a restrictive temperature, they revert to normal. And then if you move it back to the permissive temperature, they revert back to the cancer phenotype. So you can keep doing this in IE, you can keep cycling the cells from normal to cancer and back again. So this sort of raises the question that the transposed phenotype is reversible, at least to the extent that we appreciate the phenotype.
Could you go through that? It's not quite clear. Could you
did was, this is a paper in, I think, PNAS in the mid-70s, if I'm correct. They transfected normal cells, I forget what cell type this is, with RSV mutant. Yeah? So now this mutant is temperature sensitive. So when they infect it at 37 degrees, you know, it causes transformation. So when they move the transformed cells to the restricted temperature at 41 degrees, the protein fails to fold properly, it doesn't function. And so now the cell restores its original phenotype. But you can take that and move it back to 37, and again, the protein folds properly, and it causes the transformed phenotype. So you can keep doing this, as I said, you know, n number of times, and you get exactly the same result. What this tells you is that, you may not want to have permanent changes, or there may be no need to make permanent changes in order to get a transformed phenotype. That's all. That's all I'm trying to infer. Carlos is asking me, what's the relevance of this experiment to human cancer? Good question. The problem with cancer is there is no perfect model system. You can't experiment on humans, obviously. You need a model system. And as far as prostate cancer goes, I can vouch. There is no animal model that mimics prostate cancer. And the fact is, you should always take this with a grain of salt, but the fact is, other than the man's faithful friend, that is dog, no other mammal is reported to date to have prostate cancer spontaneously. As I said, you have to take that with a grain of salt. Reason being, who has looked in all the species? A. B, how do we know that they don't? Because the few species that we looked are, you know, the domesticated ones. The ones in the wilderness may get killed even before they reach maturity. Things like that, yeah? But if you believe in what I said, it is only humans that get prostate cancer. So that's the difficulty. So you got to then struggle to establish a model system. I guess this model system is as good as any. The point we want to make here is that, you know, this doesn't have to be just mutations in order to get a transformed phenotype. Yeah. So, yeah. Is that Madhyan? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. The second example, this I think Carlos already alluded to this one. This is the paper he was referring to from Beatrice Mintz's lab when she was in Fox Chase back in the 70s. Yeah? A very established researcher, a very, very reputed researcher. And here's her fantastic work. I'm directly quoting from her paper, from the abstract. The conclusive sentence says, of course, the title of the paper is Normal Genetically Mosaic Mice Produced from Malignant Teratoma Carcinoma Cell. Teratocarcinoma cell, I'm sorry. And her quote is, the results also furnish an unequivocal example in animals of a non-mutational basis of transformation to malignancy and reversal to normalcy. So I won't have time to go into the details, but all I'm going to tell you is that if nucleus from a cancer cell is taken and somatically transferred into an oocyte, and if you generate animals from that following the nuclear transplant process, you do get live birth. Of course, these animals are prone to later work, as you all know, followed by Rudy Yanish, who trained with Beatrice Mintz. You do get live births, you get normal animals, but unfortunately, they are extremely prone to developing cancer spontaneously. Other than that fact, what this important paper establishes is the fact that in spite of the mutations, the system can be reprogrammed to give you a normal animal. Yeah? That doesn't mean that those mutations were corrected. So if you go ahead and in those days they didn't, but if you now sequence them, I'm pretty sure all the mutations were there, but that they were not responsible for driving the phenotype is all I want to make a point. And then cancer cells can be reprogrammed. So here's another example that I would like to use as an illustration. So this is now epigenetic. I think Surinder was Tariq was asking about epigenetic reprogramming of breast cancer cells with oocyte extracts. Yeah? So here's another quote from the authors. Epigenetic reprogramming in oocyte extract results in reduction of cancer cell growth under anchorage-independent conditions and reduction in tumor growth in mouse xenografts. Again, they don't imply that you can cure cancer using this process, but this is a step in the right direction to show that there is potential that you can reverse this phenomenon. And there must be something that we should be able to learn from these experiments. Yeah.
Revert back to the normal phenotype, does apoptosis occurs on those cells?
Sorry?
In this set, there is a reversal to normalcy, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the idea is that the cancer cells, do they stay as such and do not function, or do they undergo apoptosis?
Remember the way the experiment was done, the nucleus was taken and transferred into the host cell.
Okay.
So all the program was reprogrammed.
Okay, so you cannot test those hypotheses.
Exactly. Every model has a limitation, believe me. Every experiment will have a limitation. But we just need to take those points that sort of are addressing the questions we went on to ask in the first place. Yeah. So that was epigenetic reprogramming. This is, I'm just trying to follow a chronology here. That was in the 70s, this is in 2011. And then finally, here's another interesting paper. I split up the chronology. I went back to 2010. But nonetheless, the point is very, very significant. Yeah? This is a paper from Jeff Settleman's lab. He's in the Fred Hutchinson in Seattle. Again, a very prominent researcher. And what he's going to show here in this paper is that there is a chromatin-mediated reversible of drug tolerance state in cancer subpopulations. So you have a cell that is shown up there. The red and blue circles there represent drug-tolerant and drug-sensitive tumor cells. So there is stochastic switching between drug-sensitive and drug-tolerant cells. So same petri dish, the population keeps switching back and forth. Very elegant demonstration in this paper. And furthermore, what was more interesting was, when he treats them with HDAC inhibitors, now HDAC inhibitors are histone-acetyl detransferase inhibitors that acetylate histone that are absolutely critical for transcription initiation. Now you can now make the drug-resistant cells sensitive just by causing that epigenetic transformation. So all these...
So if you only give the chromatin-modifying agent without the drug, they all survive?
Yeah. I will show you some data on that also. The question was, without the drug, if you just treat those cancer cells with epigenetic modifiers, will the reverse? I will show you some data. We have developed a model. It's not perfect, again, it's a model, but it'll answer some questions. Yeah. So, all in all, what I want to show you with these, just very few examples that I handpicked to make my point, is that maybe then, it's not just Darwinian evolution as has been perceived all along, it's entirely possible that there could be a Lamarckian kind of an evolutionary perspective as well. I.e., in the last slide that I showed you, it was a drug that made these cells drug resistant in the first place, and that can be oops, yeah. So now the environment is forcing to change, make a change in the phenotype. Yeah. So there is a possibility that it could be viewed as a Lamarckian evolution. So what this implies, if you accept that for a moment, is that information is bidirectional. So it can go from the genotype, but it can also be reversed from the phenotype. So nothing of this is new because all these examples I use are from published literature. But what I want to introduce now to you is this concept of this process being mediated or somehow facilitated. I don't think we have answers that convincingly will demonstrate that's the case, but I think we do have some that will at least convince you that it's worth probing further or worth considering at least the idea that we would like to propose. So IDPs I will go on to describe. So I'm now going to introduce you to the IDPs. IDP is an acronym for intrinsically disordered proteins. Happens to be one of my favorite word in our lab. What I'm also going to show you is that, or at least try to convince you, is that cancer or evolution for that matter is information transfer between, not just from genotype to phenotype. Yeah? And that biological information is actually, information transfer, is actually mediated by these protein networks, of which the intrinsically disordered proteins form very important components. And finally, I would like to say that this concept that I want to introduce to you is fundamentally very different from the prevailing theories of cancer, which we just discussed. Before I do introduce the intrinsically disordered protein, I would just like to digress a little bit and introduce yet another concept by another prominent researcher. Now, this guy is not a cancer researcher by any stretch of imagination. He is Paul Davies. I'm not too sure if anybody has heard of him, but he's an extremely well-regarded cosmologist who used to work in Cambridge in the UK, then subsequently moved to Australia, and that's when he got interested in astrobiology and was then very heavily recruited to the US by the NCI to lead this center called PSOC. Now, PSOC is Physical Sciences and Oncology Center. So there is a big thrust by the NCI now to get the physicists, and mathematicians, and theoreticians involved because somehow we are not able to make significant progress. cure the cancer. And like Carlos mentioned, several, I don't know what the number he said, several $1 billion spent, several years, several spore grants, but the numbers are still very sobering. And no matter what drug you develop, it looks like the cancers are very clever, they become resilient, they become resistant, and therefore escape a cure. So anyway, coming back to Paul Davis, as I said, he's a cosmologist, he doesn't hesitate to ask very big questions, and here is his great contribution. It's really worth thinking about it, and even if you don't like it, just fancy this for a moment. He has introduced this idea that cancer is atavism. What is atavism? I never heard of this word till I met this guy. And the dictionary definition for atavism is recurrence in an organism of a trait or character typical of an ancestral form, usually due to genetic recombination. Yeah? So, our ancestors, for example, the arboreal friends we see here have a tail. Occasionally, once in a while, very, very rare, you do find a report in the newspaper that a human is born with a tail. And this is true. It is recorded. And this phenomenon is called atavism. Yeah? So that was an ancient trait, but is suddenly recalled in the more advanced species. So it's a genuine term, it's a genuine phenomenon that's been observed, and he akins a cancer to atavism. So what is his rationale? Why does he do that? So he recently visited us at Hopkins, spent a good amount of time talking to him, and he's a very fanciful guy. So here's his idea. On one of the papers, I forgot, I'm sorry, I didn't quote his reference, but if you put in Paul Davis in PubMed, you'll get this paper. And it says, cancer is an organized, pre-programmed process driven by a cassette of highly conserved, deeply evolved ancient genes. Genes that are active in early stage embryo development and which become inappropriately reawakened in the adult form. In effect, cancer tumors are atavisms recapitulating an ancient life form, Metazoa 1.0. So I thought this was quite relevant to the theme that we then on the setup here, individuals and groups. So we will come back to this later, particularly because of a set of proteins that we are interested in. I will talk to you a little bit about. So one important thing which he has not said here in this abstract is that he believes that these genes, which are ancient and are necessary for embryonic development, are recapitulated, they are re-expressed, and we know that. Right? Every oncogene is actually a probiotic. It's involved in development, June, FOS, MYC, whatever. They're all developmental genes. They're normally expressed for normal development, but somehow get reactivated. They need not necessarily have a mutation to get reactivated. So activation mutations in many genes are not absolute must. Yeah? It can just be overexpression of these genes. And the gene, the protein that we are working with also fall in that category that no known activation mutation has been reported for these proteins. Okay? So that's the connection between atavism. So anyway, let's come back to on track. So I promised you I would introduce you to IDPs. So what are these intrinsically disordered proteins? So 2 years ago, I was just as ignorant as anybody else. I'd never heard of this word, intrinsically disordered protein. So obviously, So up until recently, and when we took our pre-qualifying exam, reading Levinger biochemistry cover to cover, this was the kind of image and impression we had about proteins, and that is, significant work in the 60s, 70s, Chris Anthonson, F.M. Richards, and Yale, and others showed that there is a beautiful correlation between structure and function, and that structure determines function, actually. So on top, you see that this happens to be RNAs, as we all know. It's completely well-folded with the subhydrils that need to be connected. You can denature that protein, completely lose its activity. You can sequentially renature it by diarizing out the denaturant, and it will regain its activity. The important thing is that it has to assume that perfect three-dimensional structure in order for it to be functional. So this was then. About 10, 15 years ago, people started noticing that a lot of proteins, and several proteins actually, do not subscribe to this fundamental dogma that structure determines function. And last year in 2011, was many of these influential journals came out with these kind of titles, Breaking Protein Rules, Dark Side of Proteins, and Scientific American, The Orderly Chaos of Proteins. Now this is not to be taken lightly, because my whole intent of presenting this conceptual idea is to excite or interest the theorists among the audience, those who work on chaos theory, nonlinear dynamics, group theory, whatever, get involved in this cancer, because it's been an extremely difficult problem. But at any rate, what this quote here was, to do their magic in the cell, proteins must fold into rigid shapes, or so standard wisdom says, but a more tangled story is beginning to emerge. And so, as I said, I admitted I didn't know what IDPs are, so my best source of reference to get information is Google. Yeah? So I put in what IDPs, and out came a definition which I was really surprised, and it says intrinsically disordered or unstructured proteins, often referred to as naturally unfolded proteins or disordered proteins, are proteins characterized by lack of a stable tertiary structure where the protein exists as an isolated peptide under physiological conditions in vitro. So that's important. Yeah? So just for deductive purposes, I have put down these two images. If you envision a folded protein to look something like the one on the left, which is perfectly ordered by excellent crystallography, a disordered protein would look something like what is shown on the right-hand side. Again, this is only in vitro conditions, remember that. So these IDPs have very important characteristics, some of which I would like to outline here. First of all, they have an innate ability to transition from disorder to order upon binding to a biological target. There's a phenomenon referred to as coupled folding and binding. Yeah? That's very important. Second, they engage in promiscuous interactions and hence are tightly regulated from transcript synthesis to protein degradation. Third, most IDPs exhibit extensive post-translational modifications. And fourth, IDPs are more likely to occupy hub positions in protein regulatory networks.
So, how can we know experimentally that a protein is disordered?
Very good question. So, I'm sorry. The question was, how do we know that a protein is structurally disordered? Yep. It's a very good question, and right now there are more than 50 algorithms out there that you can use to predict a given sequence whether it's folded or not. That's just prediction, informatics. But the experimental confirmation is either CD, quick and dirty, circular dichroism, or you can use NMR, solution NMR, and you'll see that the dispersion peaks tells you whether the protein is folded. Very good question. Again,
please repeat that again.
Yes, we'll do. So, Bram's question is, if a larger protein, yeah, has regions of disorder, is that right, Bram?
No. Suppose that it can fold this way, and this way, and when I look at the population of proteins, I have different stable ordered proteins in different states.
That
either X-ray or circular decoder, all of them will give you a signal which you could interpret as disordered.
Very good. So,
yes,
good. So, this is not more like questions. Yeah, it is a, I'm sorry. It is a question, but it's also a comment. Which is, if a given protein populates different conformers, right? So, it's conformational dynamics. You brought me right on track. That is going to be my mantra for today, conformational dynamics. Yeah. So, in most cases, when you use X-ray crystallography or NMR, these are time averaged. So what you see is an average of the population. Yeah. So that is the structure that I showed you on the previous slide. That's how the protein would look. But that rules out other states that the protein can populate. But that's the limitation of the technique. So a better technique to use is SM-FRET, and we have done that. I don't think I'll show you, but we have done that. Single molecule FRET. So you label two residues in the same protein and look for resonance energy transfer, whether it folds or does not fold. So that gives you a more in real time what kind of conformation set a protein can take.
Yeah, maybe you could carry on. I think we'll come back to some of these later.
Okay. So,
do the prions fit into the definition of IDPs?
Very good. Do the prions fit into the definition of IDPs? They're a prime example of IDPs. Alright. So let's move on. So just examples of, I told you a characteristic is coupled folding binding. So on the top, you have the lock and key mechanism that's been taught to us all along. It has a perfect shape, and if it meets a substrate of a perfect shape, it's going to interact. And then, of course, even after it disengages from that interaction, it still maintains that perfect shape, because that's what it's supposed to do. As against that, if you have an intrinsically disordered protein, it's very opportunistic. So if it sees an opportunity, it really bends itself into that mold, it interacts with that given partner, and after disengaging, it goes back to its unstructured state. So that brings up an important question. So that introduces promiscuity, because if it can just indiscriminately interact with any partner, that will create chaos, and that's exactly the basis of my talk today. That chaos, stochasticity, and conformational dynamics is what is driving these state switching, if you will, in cancer. Yeah? So here's a prime example. This is our favorite P53. This is the C-terminus of the P53 shown in those amino acid sequence. And what it is telling you here is that it can take up different conformations, and under a given conformation, it can interact with a different protein. So, just to illustrate the point of multiple interactions. The third point I told you was the IDPs typically occupy hub positions in a regulatory network or protein interaction network, and that's what is shown here in the red dots. Okay, so in this hypothetical network, it's a cartoon. The ones that are in red are supposed to represent the IDPs, and you can see most of them tend to occupy hubs. Hubs meaning a protein that has, or a node that has, multiple edges or connections to it, typically more than 10. That's what is accepted. So that brings us to another important concept, which is the topology of networks within a cell. So typically it was assumed until recently that most networks that are formed in a biological system are actually random networks, just like the cities in the US connected by the highways, the US highways. Yeah? And so if you were to plot a plot of the number of nodes versus number of links or edges, they're going to get a pretty good bell-shaped Poisson distribution, with most of them having just about the same number of connections. In this case, you can see very visually that most nodes have about 3 or 4 connections. In contrast, what was learned about 10, maybe 15 years ago by the pioneer in this is Barabasi and his colleagues, that they actually are connected in a scale-free topology. And that is like the US Airways map that is shown here. So certain cities that make up the hubs of these airlines are shown in red, and they seem to have a lot of traffic, a lot of connections, and some of the rural areas have fewer connections. Yeah? So if you were to do the same plotting here, this looks more like a power law distribution, with few nodes, the ones in red, having too many edges, and most nodes having very few edges.
Prakash,
yes,
just
sir?
In the interests of all of us knowing about everything that went on, these results of Barabasi were seriously questioned in a previous talk.
Yes.
And perhaps we can talk about the relevance of that to this talk later.
I can only imagine who questioned it. We did chat a little bit. So I admit, and I'm not a graph theory person. I told you, my qualifications to give this talk, I know nothing about this group theory, game theory, chaos theory. I'm kind of a C average guy in physics and math. Yeah, that's my only qualification to give this talk. But the ideas are very interesting, regardless of the technical details of whether the scale-free is actually like this, or you know there are variations that Jax will talk more in detail. I am not qualified to talk about that. But it's very appealing to me, and I'll sure tell you why. So what would be the advantage of having such a, let's assume for a minute, scale-free topology? So if you take a random network, and if you were to hack a few nodes, now that we know how to do that, the hacked nodes are shown in the open circuits, yeah? What happens is, just hacking a few nodes, the entire system seems to collapse. There is absolutely no communication in that network at all. On the other hand, if you were to do the same thing to a hypothetical scale-free network, that is, look what happens. Same nodes are now hacked. They're open. Yeah, they're disrupted. But look, 80-90% of the network is still functioning. So that's the beauty of having this particular kind of topology. But the flip side of that is, if you were to attack the critical nodes, then you decapacitate the whole network. So it is also susceptible. But I think the important take-home message here is, this may be one of the reasons why cancers are so resilient, because the way their networks are organized, protein-protein interaction networks, is maybe they are following this scale-free topology. And therefore, unless we hack those very critical nodes, the system is always going to be resilient, that is shown in the middle graph there. So that's our take on this particular thing. But so that brings us to the next question. If these IDPs are so important, how pervasive is this phenomenon? How prevalent are these IDPs? Surprisingly, they're extremely prevalent. Okay, and according to some estimates, the more recent ones, these are all relative because it all depends on how you slice the data. And according to some estimates, if you believe that, as much as 60% of the human proteome contributes to intrinsically disordered proteins. Now, one thing I want to make very clear, that I don't want to confuse you with the fact that when I say intrinsically disordered protein, doesn't mean that the entire protein has to be disordered. It could be regions of protein that are disordered. Now, when I say that, I need to qualify that statement, and that is, you have to have at least 30 amino acids, consecutive amino acids in a row, to be disordered, and then that portion becomes intrinsically disordered. So that's the convention that's accepted. Yeah? So if you go by those norms, then what is shown here in blue is the bacteria, archaea, and eukaryote, and there are various parameters that have been analyzed in this paper. But I just wanted to impress on you that no matter how you look at it, the eukaryotes have a preponderance of intrinsically disordered proteins in their proteome. Yes, ma'am.
I come from the protein folding community, so I always had the feeling that the native fold was something that the crystallographers had somehow put over us. Most of the proteins are extremely difficult to crystallize, as is well known. And my impression was for the last 15 years that under natural conditions, physiological conditions, most probably the proteins were not folded into one unique native state anyway. They were doing some sort of moving on some attractor, whatever. So when you're talking about these intrinsically disordered proteins, are you talking about things that are impossible to crystallize, and that's why that's what you call them, or is this what they do in vivo?
Okay, so the question and comment was, most proteins are difficult to crystallize, so are we implying that any protein that is difficult to crystallize is intrinsically disordered? It's kind of hard to answer that question because I'm not a crystallographer myself, so there must be technical difficulties. But I'll tell you how we stumbled on this. This was very serendipitously, we discovered that the protein that we are working on is entirely disordered. The reason being, we collaborated with Pam Borkman at Caltech, one of our old friends. She put a grad student to work on this project for 9 months, told me she used 650 different conditions for crystallization. She has a robot that does crystallization. pH, ionic strength, vaporization, whatever those conditions are, they failed to crystallize a protein, which led them to believe that this is intrinsically disordered. And the only thing I had to do was use one of the algorithms, feed my sequence, and lo long and behold, it was disordered. So, I don't know if I answered your question, but there is no empirical way of telling you whether the protein is disordered or not, just because it failed to crystallize. I mean, that will be, I don't know how you can define it. Okay, so let's move forward. So what's interesting to us from a cancer biology perspective is that a number of proteins that are involved in cancer or associated with cancer are intrinsically disordered. So what is shown here is, as I said, the minimum requirement is 30 consecutive amino acids. So as we walk towards the right, we are increasing the stringency. We are asking for proteins of longer than 100 amino acids or so to be intrinsically disordered. Obviously, that number will come down. But what is shown here for comparison is just random proteins taken from the protein database. And the numbers here, the N numbers are very significant. They are in the thousands, perhaps. Dominant, and the next prominent class is those involved in signaling. And it's not surprising, and I'll show you some data, that IDPs are particularly associated with the cancer and with signaling. And what is more interesting is not only that those were associated with cancer, but some of our favorite molecules that most cancer biologists are concerned with, the FOS, JERN, MYC, what have you, most of them range anywhere from 47% to almost 87% disorder. That's a pretty significant extent of disorder in some of these very, very heavily implicated proteins. So this really excited us a lot. We thought we should pursue this. And so we work on a group of proteins. This is my chance to introduce you to what we work on more specifically. And these are called the cancer testis antigens. Yeah? So as the name itself implies, these are proteins that are typically expressed in the male germ cells in the testis, nowhere else in the somatic tissues of the body. Yeah? But all of a sudden, when you have cancer, they all get reactivated. I wouldn't say all, but most get reactivated. And of course, there is, in every given cancer type, the different kinds of CTAs get expressed. Let's be very clear with that. So we looked at, using these algorithms, of how many CTAs are actually disordered. So we came up with this nice little paper. The editor decided to put it on the cover, but he made a blatant mistake. I'm very embarrassed about it. And he wrote that, he or she, I don't know, said that CTA is equal to disordered protein. I mean, this is not actually true because there are examples of CTA that are not disordered and there are examples of disordered proteins that are not CTAs. Okay, so that's not my fault. So what are these CTAs? So why are we so interested? As I said, first of all, they are expressed only in the male germ cells. So they represent very attractive biomarkers because they are not expressed in normal tissue. More important, Some of them are expressed in embryonic stem cells and trophoblasts, suggesting that they may play a more fundamental role other than spermatogenesis itself. We can forget the rest, minor things. But here's to come to the point that Paul Davies is very fascinated about, the atavism problem, right? So these genes involved or proteins involved in embryonic development are re-expressed in cancer. So here's a prime example. So this is a cartoon that I modified from a review by Lloyd Old. And what he went on to show that a number of these characteristics are shared between these three phenomena, namely embryonic development, spermatogenesis, and tumor genesis. Yeah? So of all those, the only thing that is common to all three phenomena is the expression of the cancer testis antigens. And remember I mentioned that there is no report of an activating mutation in the CTAs. So the mere upregulation of these CTAs, which are intrinsically disordered by the way, appears to be correlating with some aspect of cancer. And another interesting feature about these CTAs is that they're pretty recent in evolution. So on the right, on the left, I'm sorry, are genes that are typically used for reprogramming. And you can see that they're fairly well conserved between species. On the right in the box are the CT antigens. And what you see is actually some of them are just seen only in the human, Homo sapiens, that's the Bate genes, and you don't even see them in the related primates. And we have taken this very seriously. We actually have a manuscript in preparation where we have analyzed it in incredible depth, and we are convinced that we do not find these genes beyond the primate lineage. So, another interesting feature about these genes is that they seem to be concentrated on the X chromosome. So there are about 200 or so CTAs known today, of which 100 or odd CTAs are concentrated on the X chromosome. That is what is shown here. So what I'm showing you in green is the number of genes in each chromosome, starting from chromosome 1. And as you walk your way to the right, you see the X on the Y chromosome, and it becomes immediately apparent that the X chromosome is colored almost in red, suggesting that more than 50% of all the CTAs reside on this X chromosome. And a more recent paper showed that almost 80% of the genes that are coded on the X chromosome encode intrinsically disordered proteins. So we're not too sure what this means, but we're very intrigued that such a large concentration of intrinsically disordered protein should be located on the X chromosome. All right, so I'm going to skip this in the interest of time. I already convinced you that we have data to show the CTAs are disordered, so let's skip that. So here's another interesting observation. This is an independent observation by a group in Pittsburgh. And it's kind of a busy slide, but let me explain. What we're looking here is at three different species. So we're going from E. coli to yeast to human. And what we're looking at is three different GO is the gene ontologies. So there are various ways how you can classify given genes or proteins. So the gene ontology is a standard accepted way of classifying them. So you can categorize genes or proteins into genes that are proteins that do a function of binding. So this is by functional classification. Genes that are involved in catalysis, that would be enzymes, and genes that are involved in transcriptional regulation. Yeah. So what becomes very apparent is in E. coli, it really doesn't care for intrinsically disordered. So in each category, just about the same number of genes are disordered or ordered. But if you look at yeast and human, it turns out as far as transcription and binding, that would be protein-protein interaction, it prefers, these systems prefer to have intrinsically disordered proteins rather than coded proteins. Yeah? And one last point about these IDPs is that they are associated with a phenomenon called dosage sensitivity. Now again, that's very important for us in cancer. So what is that supposed to mean? So here's in this paper, what the authors did was they took the yeast proteome, they analyzed it, and figured that you can express as much as 80% of the yeast proteome, overexpress it, and there is no effect on the phenotype. However, there is this 20% of the genome. If you overexpress them, you get a toxic phenotype. Yeah. So they set out to see what is so unique about this 20% that causes this toxic phenotype, and the overwhelming feature that they noticed was intrinsic disorder. So they came up with this title that intrinsic disorder associated with dosage sensitivity. And they didn't stop at yeast, they then went on to do the same thing informatically in flies, in worms, in mice, and then finally in human. And every which case you look at, there is a strong correlation between intrinsic disorder and either toxic in lower organisms or pathologic effect in higher organisms. So that is not surprising given the data I showed you earlier, a lot of genes associated with cancer are intrinsically disordered. Okay, so now I'm going to tie this whole thing together, and this is where the theorists in the audience would be quite excited, I think. So before I do that, let me just explain. Vidyanand said I have 5 more minutes, so it will be a challenge to go through this, but maybe in the interest of time, what I can do is, let me just explain this model. So, again, we need a model system to study prostate cancer. As I said, there's no good model system, so we developed our own. And this is a very specialized model where we are looking at the mechanism of drug resistance. Yeah? So, we took DU145 cells. These are a line of prostate cancer cells that are metastatic. We treated them with paclitaxel, which is one of the favorite drugs used for chemotherapy. And we identified two kinases, kinase 1, kinase 2, that get phosphorylated. The entire kinase is not upregulated, but the phospho form of that particular kinase is upregulated. So obviously there's a kinase that phosphorylates this kinase. So we went on to now make these cells drug resistant. So we treated them with various concentrations of the drug for over a 1 year period. So which means they underwent more than 300 generations of duplications. So look at the ones in the blue, that is the parental cell line. They are very sensitive. If you go to 100 nanomolar of the drug, the cells die, 99%. But the ones that are resistant, you can go really up to 100 nanomolar and a significant portion of them still survive. Then we did another clever experiment. We took those cells that were resistant and grew them in media without the drug for another 6 months. Actually, now it's gone on to 9 months. Yeah? We were surprised that they still retained their drug sensitivity, drug resistance, I'm sorry. What we would have expected is, if this were a temporary phenomenon, these cells would have become sensitive as soon as we put them in media without the drug, and we challenged them. But to our surprise, they remained drug sensitive over a 9 month period now.
That's the exact thing that you would expect if it is genetic.
If it is, yeah, I'm going to come to that point, exactly. So Madhavan says this is exactly what you would expect if there was a permanent change, right? A genetic change. That's exactly what I'm going to tell you. So, we looked at the kinases. Again, we got the same exact kinases, phosphokinases upregulated. So the mechanism of whether you treat them for 24 hours, whether you treat them for 1 year, at least one readout we have is this kinase where that gets phosphorylated. Then we got hold of drugs that inhibit the specific kinases. They are readily available in the market. And we know that if you inhibit them with the drug, you lose the kinase activity. And we wanted to implicate these kinases, the readouts that we are using, as important for drug resistance, as one of the mechanisms. Now we heard that multi-drug resistance protein is one mechanism that was in breast cancer. Perhaps every cancer is different. In this case of prostate cancer, it could be these kinases that are important. To show that they indeed are really important, we inhibited them with the same inhibitors, and you can see that they lose their drug resistance and they become very sensitive. So this brings up Mahadevan's question, which is, what is this supposed to mean? Was that change permanent, or was that change genetic or epigenetic? Yeah? So if it was permanent, obviously it should not have lost its drug resistance, right? So obviously this implicates that it is some kind of a change. It could be permanent, but it's definitely not, or may most likely not involve a genetic alteration that is responsible for drug resistance.
Why do you say that? It seems it's exactly the opposite.
Why is that?
If it's heritable,
yeah.
For example,
well, you could have epigenetic changes.
I'm sorry, we could come. Yeah, no, I'm not saying it proves anything, but a change which is heritable for a long time, you would guess would be a genetic change.
And I spoke ahead of my turn. What was I going to show you in the we asked the question. Now, this could mean either it is permanent or it is not. Yeah. So how are we going to settle that? So there is ample evidence that it could be permanent. And here's a great example from a most recent work from Bob Austin's group. He's the PI for our PSOC center at Princeton. And what he did was, he took bacteria, challenged them with Cipro, and he asked whether Cipro treatment induces a permanent change in this bacteria. In other words, does it cause mutations and a resistant variety emerges? And that's exactly what he reported. He emphatically states in this paper that it was not a pre-existing strain that got selected upon drug exposure, yeah? But that there was a de novo mutation caused by this drug treatment. and he goes on to map those. So this is a circus plot, if you're not very familiar. So what we're looking at is various colonies that were picked up. They were completely sequenced. Now that's feasible. You can do that for a few thousand dollars. And what he's showing you in those various colored dots are the SNPs, or single base mutations that are caused. And on the right, he shows you a little cartoon, three-dimensional structure of the DNA gyrase in which this mutation was induced. And that's exactly where Cipro binds. So it's a beautiful example of how the environment induced a permanent change in this particular organism. Yeah? We are in the process of doing the same thing now. Bacteria obviously is easy to sequence. Mammalian cells are admittedly hard. It's not trivial, but it's not impossible to do it either. It's just the cost factor. Currently, we are running between $8,000 to $10,000 per run.
What's this relation?
Ciprofloxacin specific.
Exactly.
And no, I think that is not correct.
Can we jump to this later once you wind up?
Okay.
It's not direct relation.
Yeah.
Why would you say that?
Because there are evidence to show that other antibiotics.
Exactly. That's what the guidance thing works on others.
Yeah, I agree.
Please repeat that.
Yeah. Okay, that's a very subtle point, though. I overlooked this point. I admit. It's an important point. I admit. It's a subtle but important point. In my anxiety to cover time, I overlooked that point. But he's right. Bob Austin emphasizes this as well, which is the one thing he emphasizes. Okay, let's be agree on that. Is that he did not select bacteria that were resistant to Cipro. Yeah, they were sensitive to begin with. But that when he treated them with Cipro, he gets these mutations that were selected in response to Cipro treatment. However, the same mutations are also sensitive, resistant to other antibiotics that he used in the same experiment. So that's an important point. So as I said, we are in the process of doing the same exact thing. The data are being analyzed right now. The sequencing part is easy. It's the bioinformatics that takes humongous time to get meaningful data. But if you take my word for that, we also in the meantime wanted to check whether this is epigenetically driven or not. And to our great surprise, when we just treated the cells, we saw how we can rescue the drug resistance. This implies that at least in part, that the resistance that we see is driven by epigenetics. Yeah? So now we are going on to do the AZA and SAHA treatment. So AZA for the theorists is azacitidine, which demethylates methylated DNA. So that also is epigenetic.
What's
the other drug?
Azacitidine.
The other drug. Or SAHA. That's histone deacetylase H90. So, yes.
But that epigenetic factor at first place could have come from a genetic change.
I suggest we take this up later.
Okay. So, alright. So transient versus permanent, we are debating on that. So regardless, when and how were these changes caused, and is this indicating reverse flow of information? Those are the two questions that have intrigued us. I don't think we have the complete answer to that, but certainly the experiments that we are doing are in those exact directions. So I will now just conclude. What I wanted to say was, conceptually speaking, this idea that this phenotype can drive changes in the genotype is not new. This has been discussed time and time again, but it's time and time has been seriously ignored as well. So let's bring it to the fore now, and this is Conrad Waddington, as we all know. This is his famous epigenetic model in A, where a ball is rolling down several hills and valleys. Those are the options that are available to the ball, i.e. representing the various options that a cell has during its process of differentiation. And down there are the pegs, those represent the genes, and these he called attractors. So a certain creod or a valley that's available, the ball traverses, now becomes fixed, if you will, and that's canalized in his words, and therefore you get a certain phenotype. And the other options, other valleys that are not utilized in this particular process, he called them as masked, and they are unavailable to this particular phenotype. So I've tried to redraw this cartoon in terms of what we think how cancer works. And we also coined this word decentralization. Now this is what we came up with. It's not been a standard practice to use this, but if you take that for the moment, what I want to show you here on the in panel A is a pluripotent stem cell, and the ball is rolling down. It has several options available to it. It can go any which way, and that would determine the fate of that cell. In panel B, in a normal cell, for example, it would take a certain pathway, and that would commit it to become differentiated to that particular phenotype. And then in C, you have the cancer cell, where we invoke this process of decanalization. Yeah. So the path that was masked in the previous option, now in the cancer cell, becomes this latent option, path become unmasked, and therefore the cell reverts to becoming cancerous. And this has been, this can be substantiated, if you will, because if you look down in D, you can then reprogram the cell, and this has been a beautiful work done in the last 5 years by Shin Yamanaka and several other people, where you can take these four transcription factors, and as Tariq was mentioning this morning, you can completely reprogram this somatic cell into pluripotent stem cell. Yeah? And we believe that in cancer, perhaps something similar is happening. That would, what Dr. Rangarajan was alluding to, this in her talk, is the so-called cancer initiating cell or cancer stem cell. You could have a cancer cell, but that these factors can reprogram it to give rise to a cancer stem-like cell. So, but the only difference we want to invoke here is that this is not driven just by genes, but that the products of the genes, namely the proteins, the interactions, and the network that is created by these interactions is the one that is really driving these various options. So, just for the skeptic in the audience, the four factors that were used by Yamanaka and others, OCT34, c-MYC, TLF4, SOX2, I've done a very simple fold index plot for you. Each one of them is intrinsically disordered. Yeah. So, in concluding, what I want to show is a cartoon that very recently appeared by a theoretical biologist. His name is Sui Hong. He's in the Institute of Systems Biology, started by Lee Hood. And he, I was kind of gratified to see that somebody else also agrees with similar ideas that we are proposing here. And that is, there are certain options that are masked in a normal cell. So those are the options that is shown in yellow, the ball coming down. That would give rise to, I don't think, like a muscle cell, liver cell, etc. But on the left are options that were masked, that were not available, but that if they become unmasked, unused attractors, as he refers to, are the ones that drive this tumorigenesis process. Yeah. So before I end here, what I would like to emphasize that the message I want to give away is that the intrinsically disordered proteins, yeah, they have this latent information because, as I told you, they're an ensemble of conformations. So they can take up various conformations. And under different conformations, they can interact with different partners, and therefore they can keep rewiring the protein interaction network. And depending on what network is created, there will be an outcome. You'll get a different phenotype. And therefore, in our opinion, it's a highly probabilistic model. There doesn't seem to exist a cell that is defined or has a predetermined genotype that would give rise to cancer or be drug resistance or what have you. But it's every cell has the same opportunity to either become a cancer cell or a drug resistant cell or a stem cell. So with that, I'd just like to thank my collaborators. That's Rob Getzenberg, he's our director. We work very closely with him. He's an expert cancer biologist. Most of the work that I showed you or alluded to, didn't really show you all the data, is done by Kritika Rajgopal, and she's now moving on to Columbia. She was a tech in my lab. She's now accepted in a PhD program. Geeta Mahmudbadi is a grad student at Caltech. She also worked in our lab for a year, and she's in a PhD program there. And Govindan Rangarajan is a mathematician who's helping us model this. We have a manuscript that's been submitted putting out this model. Hopefully one day we'll have it in print, and I'll be able to share that with you. So that's it. Thank you so much.
Subhash had a question midway, which I stopped. Hang on, you get a mic.
Yeah.
Before repeating that question, I want to know what kind of drug that Shaha is, how it is inhibiting the...
It's an HDAC inhibitor.
Okay. So, on the basis of that result, you are implying that it is an epigenetic change.
Yeah.
So my question is, that epigenetic factor at first place could have come from a genetic change. Because the drug is not really removing the marks, it is inhibiting a protein.
It's inhibiting an enzyme that acetylates histones.
Yeah, so that enzyme, the altered property of that enzyme could have come from a genetic change.
I see what you're saying. No, our implication is that the following. So even as far as epigenetic marks go, right, whether you want to go modify a particular gene in terms of methylation, or you want to modify this particular histone, H3K4, for example, somebody has to direct those enzymes to that particular location such that it gets epigenetically modified. So who's going to direct those enzymes to those sites? So our belief is that these protein networks that we talked about, many of the IDPs are indeed chromatin remodelers. So I didn't get time to go into that. But many of the IDPs, or let's put it another way, many of the chromatin remodelers are intrinsically disordered proteins. So by rewiring networks, they can now guide. In fact, there's ample evidence to show that transcription factors form a nexus with the chromatin remodelers that are intrinsically disordered, and so do DNA repairing enzymes form a nexus with the intrinsically disordered proteins.
So you talked about the structure motifs or domains, so I'm more interested in what are the structural motifs or the domains in these intrinsically disordered proteins, because you said prions are one of the prime examples of the IDPs.
Exactly.
Prions have this glutamine and asparagine rich, so they are, you know, from the yeast.
Exactly.
Are there such domains existing in IDPs?
Absolutely. One of the hallmarks of characterizing an IDP, you can actually, now I can look at a sequence and tell you right away whether it's IDP or not. It's very simple. The secret is there are a high preponderance of charged and polar amino acids, such as glutamines, for example, arginines, most of the polar amino acids, yeah? But and equally important, there's a paucity of the hydrophobic or the non-polar amino acids. So in the case, the first protein that I talked to you about, there's only one valine, that's it. There's no isoleucine, no phenylalanine, no tryptophan, no tyrosines.
So what I'm understanding, you have like, just like prion domains, you have Q and N-rich domains?
Now, prion is an exception that you have a polyglutamine run in them. But otherwise, it is just like interdigitated with the charge and polar amino acids. A glutamine can be one of those.
So, what the next question related to the same thing, if you have a domain. So, what leads to this transition from IDP to an ordered form and vice versa? So, do you have something like, you think, environment or whatever, intrinsic environment or extrinsic?
So,
it's leading to some post-translational modifications,
yeah.
It's leading to some, you know,
yeah.
Some other changes?
Absolutely. This is how we demonstrate that a protein, that an IDP can fold actually. So there are various ways. A, you can use an osmolite like TMAO. So TMAO can induce. So what it does is actually molecular crowding, right? It forces. So the molecules that are available in the space that this protein is sharing with, it crowds it such that it is driven to fold. Yeah? Or it can interact with the biological partner. In our case, we found C-jun interacts with our protein. So we have our protein labeled with N15 and we have C-jun that is unlabeled. We put them together and we record the NMR spectra, and you can see that the peaks are now dispersed, suggesting that it is interacting. The third way you can confirm is using SM-FRET or single molecule fluorescence energy transfer microscopy. And as I told you, you can see if you have a donor acceptor, there is no FRET signal in the absence of the interactor. If you add the interactor, then they come together. And it's time dependent, so you can do this in microseconds if you will. Folding, unfolding, you see the spectrum.
Yeah, I was really curious about, you know, when you put up the genotype to phenotype bidirectional flow.
Yeah.
But then I don't think you ever said anything about that except for talking about chromatin remodeling, you know, which is, or changes in gene expression. Now, typically when you talk about the genotype, phenotype, unidirectional flow, it's really about the fact that, you know, genetic changes of some sort in the sequence are not driven by. Did you actually mean genotype to phenotype, or did you just mean chromatin remodeling?
I meant phenotype to genotype, yes.
Did you mean phenotype to genotype?
Yeah.
Anything beyond chromatin remodeling?
sequence changes? Because there is a paper that I sent to Vidyananda, we didn't discuss it later, but from the Hopkins group. So here's what happens. If you treat prostate cancer cells, so you have prostate normal cells, you can take them through a few passages, they don't last very long, normal epithelial cells, and you can take prostate cancer cells, yeah, like the one I showed. And you can treat them with androgen. When you treat them with androgen, the androgen receptor gets activated, yeah. And in the normal cell, it just goes and transcribes its target genes. But in the cancer cell, what it does, in addition to transcribing genes, it also induces severe double-strand breaks. And those breaks are repaired, and that is one of the reasons how you get this depressor fusion, which is one of the hallmarks of prostate cancer, actually, now, shown by Arul Chinnaya and others, that you get one gene, Tempress, it's an X transcription factor, they get fused, and this fusion is mediated by the androgen receptor. And the androgen receptor happens only in the cancer cells, it doesn't happen in the cancer cells.
Can I interject here?
Yes.
Are you saying that some of the proteins which are intermediaries in cancer are also mutagenic? Is that you're saying, what all you're saying, or are you saying something beyond that?
I'm giving you this one specific example that that may be the case.
So that was mutagenic.
It was.
But I think that's slightly different from the question which was asked, which is, can a phenotypic change drive a genotypic change?
That's exactly what happened. Now you had a change in the phenotype. You have androgen receptor upregulated in prostate cancer, and this is exactly what it went and did.
No, for example, in bacterial systems as well, under certain stress conditions, the rate of mutation increases.
Yes.
But you wouldn't call that as saying that the environment is now changing the genotype, it's just the rate of mutation has gone up.
Not only did the rate increase, but it selected those genotypes to be beneficial, so it was a mutated phenotype, actually.
Yeah, but a mutated phenotype is not the same as an agent, is not equivalent to an agent which changes the genotype in a specific direction.
So mutated phenotype is defined as an increase in the mutational rate, ultimately selected those that are beneficial.
Right.
Correct. So I'm implying that in this particular case, that was the system was driven to that.
To become a mutated phenotype.
Yeah. You saw that in that slide I showed you.
Yeah, but I think it's somewhat different from saying that the phenotype has driven a specific, or the information from the phenotype is flown into a specific.
I would hate to admit it, but I will admit it, and all I'm trying to say is, you know, these are steps in the direction to show that we should change our thinking, and we should not be just subscribing to one view that mutations drive the whole process.
No, fair enough.
That's all. That's all I'm trying to make.
I think the important point is there empirical evidence which points in that direction?
Well, once we start thinking in this way, we will now design experiments to test it. That's the impression I want to leave you with. I don't mean to imply that we have answers to every question, or even that we ask the right question. Perhaps some of these questions need to be asked.
Yeah, last
year.
I have two quick questions. The first is the link between embryonic development and tumorigenesis you mentioned. I was wondering, is there evidence to link the cellular movements you get during embryonic development with patterns in metastasis? Is there any evidence?
Evidence? Well, if you think about it, yeah, the metastatic process itself, the invasion, the aggressiveness with which the embryo implants...
I mean the direction. So from specific sites to, let's say, some cancers only metastasize to whatever, the lung. Does that mirror the pattern of cell movement during embryonic development of those cells, whatever the epithelium?
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, the second question is with relation to the prion-like phenomenon. You said these IDPs are prions are examples of IDPs. So in yeast prions, we know that there are heat shock proteins that stabilize the prion state.
Yeah.
So under conditions of stress, like temperature stress, we know there's an increase in the switching frequency for the formation of the prion. So I was wondering if there's something similar maybe happening with your cancer model in IDP. Not switching necessarily, but change to the cancerous state under stress. So there's an environmental stress that induces.
Yes, I can share one bit of information with you that HSP90 itself is an intrinsically disordered protein, and so are many of the stress proteins actually.
Maybe, but I mean under stress.
Can you be specific in your question?
Yeah. Under stress.
Okay, I said what I meant was in prions, there is evidence to suggest that normally the prion state is stabilized by certain HSPs. So under stress, when you have fewer of these HSPs at a higher temperature, for example, you get a greater switching frequency. So more of the prion is formed per unit length. So in your cancer model, I'm asking, is it possible that your tumorigenesis, whatever, conversion to cancer cells, is happening because these intrinsically disordered proteins are no longer well stabilized by HSPs or the chaperones?
Absolutely.
There could be an
XC
link there, which is...
Yeah, yeah. I would like to use the example Dr. Nagarajan showed, that in a tumor, right, geographically speaking, you know, the center of a tumor is very different from the periphery of the tumor, right, geographically speaking. In IE, they could be experiencing more hypoxia, stress, what have you, right? So cells that express these IDPs, let's assume that they are the same IDP that are expressed, but they will be quantitatively different because their response as IDPs is different, yeah? Not only that, as I said, crowding, pH, ionic strength, oxygen tension, everything influences their conformational dynamics. And this is what we are currently testing. We are collaborating with Bob Austin, where we have designed a microfluidic chip, and we can now inject the protein, unfolded protein, which is labeled. And now we can use the microfluidic channels to drive a gradient of either pH or ionic strength or something. Under those conditions, you want to map the various conformations that the protein takes. So that would imply that under different stress conditions, they take different conformations. And if they take different conformations, they're going to interact with different proteins and therefore rewire the networks. So in other words, I'm saying there's information in this protein that is absolutely latent, right? And this latent information gets exposed, the networks get rewired, and that information is now transferred to the genome, at least transiently. I don't have a specific example of permanent changes, but at least this goes to imply that there could be information that's going in this way.
Aisha?
You partially answered my question.
I will try again.
Sorry?
I'll try again to answer.
You partially answered my the question that was going around in my head. Regarding these things being, these chains being predominantly hydrophilic, you're saying, I mean, since they're all charged or polar amino acids, it's not folding properly because the folding is
driven
by...
Can you hold it closer?
Then it goes when?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I'm asking, can you guess or have you observed whether they would be able to fold better in highly ionized media, which would sort of provide a buffer to certain parts of the protein so that it could then fold? I mean, have you made any of these microfluidic experiments that you're thinking on? Have you observed this? Which I want to tie with the following question. You asked in the very beginning, you said, that these were a sort of throwback to a very early stage of evolution, some atavistic kind of. So would you be able to make a connection, although hypothetical, between the conditions under which these chains do fold into some recognizable shape and early stages of evolution?
It's an interesting thought, and one piece of information that I can share with you is that now there is a paper that we just got a hold of showing empirical evidence that most of the amino acids that came first on the surface of this earth, if you will, are the polar and charged amino acids. Yeah, they came first compared to the non-polar and hydrophobic amino acids. So if you were given that option, only option, you have a charged and polar amino acids, and there was no genetic code at that point, and you randomly strung them together, you're bound to make an intrinsically disordered protein. So that's all I can share.
I have a comment and a question.
Yes, sir.
That is unrelated to the comment. The comment is that we are using very lightly certain words that supposedly should be used with concern.
Yes.
There are operational terms that we use. For example, stem cells, cancer stem cells, normal stem cells, without defining what you really mean. Especially, and I say operational, because we define or we point at them after the fact. In other words, we cannot anticipate which cell will become a stem cell. stem cell, and then when we see something that we like, we say, ah, that is a stem cell. So I think that the, for purpose of communication and be clear about what we mean, we should define what the stem cell is. The second question at this regard is the use of the term differentiated. All my cells are differentiated in the context of evolution. Without my toenails, I would not be here. But of course, we always say that my brain cells are much more important than my toenails, which is, from an evolutionary point of view, totally true. Now, I think that unless we clarify what we are talking about, I think that we are making a mess out of the discourse that we are having. This is the comment. The question is, 7 years ago, that design was very popular. To what you attribute that the meager results that came out of drug design?
Sorry, I didn't follow your question. What was the question?
Let me try to repeat it.
Yeah.
Several years ago, drug design was very popular.
Yes.
I presume you mean anti-cancer drugs?
Yeah. Computer-assisted drug design.
To what do you attribute the meager results from drug design?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Meager results of what?
Of drug design, attempts to design drugs targeted against, I guess.
Why would we say they are meager? I mean, they have been quite successful.
I understand that the drug companies are complaining that they have nothing in their pipeline.
I don't know. I'm not in a drug company, so I can't answer that question.
This is what they say.
So, I'm not sure what the question is, what your concern is. And second of all, Carlos, I mean...
So can it be expected that some of these IDPs may fall prey to the proteasome degradation machinery?
Bring up a very interesting point, my friend. I wrote a little commentary or a thought article, not even an article, several couple of paragraphs in a minor journal. I can send it to you, but this is exactly what occurred to me one night. Every cell, I mean, so beautifully tuned and has a beautiful a policing system, right? A quality control system. That if a protein that is, as it emerges through the large subunit of the ribosome, it is chaperoned. And it is inherently programmed to, you know, fold in itself. If for some reason, if it fails to do that, the chaperone is assisted to fold. And therefore, it is now taken up as a properly folded protein. It's allowed to get into the cytoplasm, do whatever it has to do. In instances where even after aiding, it fails, then it is culled, it is marked by ubiquitination, and sent to the proteasome for degradation, right? So the question occurred to me, how come then the intrinsically disordered protein escaped this quality control mechanism? So I've just made a suggestion and I said, remember the point I made that these intrinsically disordered proteins, they transition from disorder to order upon interacting with the partner, yeah? And they're totally indiscriminate at to some extent. So my hypothesis was that as soon as they interact with the chaperon, they trick the chaperon to thinking that they are folded, which they might very well be. The chaperone, thinking that it has folded, disengages, and the moment it gets into the cytoplasm, it again becomes chaperone. So, speculative hypothesis.
Can you last?
If I remember correctly, you mentioned that you made your cells drug resistant.
Yeah.
By treating them initially for a very long period of time with drugs.
Over a year, yes.
Over a year.
Yeah.
Is it not possible that in this duration, you have actually selected a subpopulation? And in that, if that is true, then how does your model differ from selection of subpopulation of pre-existing cells, which are drug resistant?
It's entirely possible, yeah. But that is not the question that we were asking, actually. Regardless of whether we selected or not, the question was whether this is due to a permanent change or it's a temporary change. So to answer the former, we have resorted to whole genome sequencing. And for the latter, I showed you preliminary data using the HDAC inhibitors. So we are going to pursue that with the azacitidine treatment. And
I'm also not clear in which way your model differs from Jeff Settleman's persisters in the cancer
cell. I'm not even sure that we want to address persisters. That's a phenomenon well known in bacterial population. The idea has been floated around for cancer cells, but there is no solid evidence to back it up that there is a persistent phenomenon in mammalian cells.
But I thought you yourself put that up and said that it's a very good paper that talked about a model of drug resistance.
It is stochastic, it's not persistent. So it can switch between states. So it's state switching. So that's different from persistent.
These IDPs are required both for tumor initiation, maintenance, progression, as well as maintenance.
You can imply that if you believe that all the MYC and CGUN and others are IDPs,
yeah.
Perhaps they are, yes.
All I am trying to think is that, is it a group of IDPs that play a role, or a single IDP can take over all the functions and it will be implied for therapeutic purposes?
Well, if you believe the Shin Yamanaka data, you needed four. You know how they did that experiment, right? They went through a library of CDNs. They finally narrowed it down to four transcription factors, and subsequent work by others showed that you can use even two factors and they can reprogram the somatic cell into a stem cell. Now, whether the cells that these people use also had the other transcription factors and therefore they cooperated, I can't promise.
So, Prakash, I would like to caution you regarding when you're saying no genetic change because you're using the SAHA, which is the histone-deacetylase inhibitor. So you can't rule out still a genetic change because using SAHA, you are upregulating or downregulating something like 200 genetic networks or protein networks,
yeah,
which may be acting as, you know, suppressor mutations of the genetic mutation which you may have accumulated. So I would like you to have the whole genome sequencing of this cell line.
Absolutely.
Only then you would be able to conclude. And if you are going to add, now you are saying SAHA plus 5 as acetylene, you will be having thousands of genes up and down regulated.
Oh yes, yes. But remember, that's why we had to develop that marker that we are following. You know, we have no interest in the mechanism of drug resistance. We are just using that phosphoform of that kinase as our readout. That's why we spent so much time developing that marker. So, and again, if I misspoke, I apologize. I did not mean to imply that there are no genetic changes. I said the data is in progress, so we are assembling the informatics to know whether there is any contribution by genetic change or not. But the fact that they responded to a SAHA treatment, at least in part, is due to epigenetic. That's all I want to say.
Yeah, but the point is, let's say a genetic mutation is acting as a poison for the cells. Now you are adding another poison down, play the effect of one poison, so you know it does not rule out any genetic changes.
Right.
So you may have still accumulated some genetic changes, unless you show that at the sequence level there is none in the gene.
Right. Agreed. Well taken.
Before ending, can I make a request of each of the three speakers of this cancer session? Would it be possible for you to say in one short sentence what you think is the defining element of the model that you presented, which sets it off against the other two? Just for us, the rest of us, to clarify our thoughts. Or if you think there is none and the models really share a lot in common with each other, please say so too.
In fact, I don't think any of these models is mutually exclusive. To me, it appears that cancer evolves and there are cancers probably that follow his model or Carlos's model or my model. So I look at any model that comes up in a way to, if we can explain it, it's great. I do not look at the way of saying that my model is correct or your model is incorrect. So all these could be happening in the same patient, in the same cancer, within the same tumor.
Well said.
Obviously, I disagree. I think that, as I mentioned, I am a believer that science is a serious endeavor and that it's not a democracy. It is a dictatorship, and there are people who, for a while, have the power, and with time, they lose it. And if we capture what we call anticipated mix or sharing of all the premises, you will never rule out anything. And I think that that is not the purpose of science. Exact sciences precisely follow this pattern that for a while you are the king until you are demonstrated wrong. And I think that unless we take the example of the exact sciences, biology will be mired in this mess in which we are.
Prakash?
Yeah, I, for the most part I agree with both of them, and all I want to not be politically correct. So, anyway, but I do want to make the point that you know, everybody looks at a problem very differently. We all see the same thing, but we need to think differently. That's where you make discoveries. I'm not implying that we have made any discovery, but I'm just trying to say that looking at, you know, that these molecules, these protein molecules that are so predominant, as I said, 60% by some estimates, should have latent information that they can use to their advantage. It's something I think pretty intriguing, at least to us. And it's good food for theoreticians to use this information and start modeling some of this work, which we have already started working with Rangarajan.
Thanks very much, Ben.